Every day we go about our lives in the most ordinary ways. We wake up and go through our morning routines, having some coffee, maybe a little breakfast, and head off to work. And all the while, we never suspect that this could be the worst day of our lives, or that it could possibly be the last day of our lives. Today on The Secret Sits, we are going to discuss the worst day in the lives of everyone involved in the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre. Shortly after 8 a.m. on the 10th of February, 1990, police received a call from a distressed child who claimed she had been shot in the head. And that is where our story begins. Las Cruces, which translates to the Crosses, is the second largest city in the state of New Mexico. Las Cruces is the economic and geographic center of the Mesilla Valley, the architectural region on the floodplain of the Rio Grande, which extends from Hatch to the west side of El Paso, Texas. The Las Cruces Bowling Alley was a family-owned business. That Saturday had started like any other. 34-year-old Stephanie Senak was at the bowling alley, getting ready for the busy day ahead. Her daughter Melissa Rapace tagged along with her. The business was a family affair. While Stephanie managed the day-to-day running of the business, her father Ron owned the bowling alley. 12-year-old Melissa and her friend Amy Hauser, who was 13, were working at the daycare facility in the bowling alley that day and were preparing the space. This day was the Youth Bowling League Day. The alley's cook, Ida Holguin, was in the kitchen firing up the fryers and getting ready for the onslaught of children she'd be feeding for the day. A short time later, between 8 a.m. and 8:20 a.m., Steve Senak, Stephanie's brother and Melissa's uncle, arrived at the bowling alley to pick up a bag that he had left there. When he arrived at the bowling alley, Steve notices a few things that seem strange. He saw that the front doors were unlocked, which they were not supposed to be until the bowling alley is scheduled to open. And he also saw two men who were walking through the parking lot from the direction of the back of the building. One was much older than the other, and Steve saw them pass a small case between them. Thinking nothing of it, Steve grabbed his bag from the alley and dropped into Stephanie's office to tell her to keep the front doors locked before 9 a.m. He then left the building and continued his morning. Melissa and Amy were already hungry and asked Stephanie for some pocket change to buy snacks from the vending machines before customers started arriving. They leave the office around 8:20 a.m. to go to the vending machines. However, they never got to the machines because on their way, they were confronted by two men standing in the open doorway of the bowling alley holding guns. One of the men took the girls into the manager's office where a surprise Stephanie was still working, and the other man went to find Ida in the kitchen. He returned with the frightened cook holding a .22 caliber pistol to her head, and the group were told to get on the ground. During the course of all of this happening, another bowling alley worker, Steve Taran, showed up for work. Steve was the alley mechanic and had problems finding childcare that morning, so instead of calling into his work, he brought his daughter, Valerie, 2 years old, and stepdaughter Paula, who was 6 years old, to the bowling alley with him. Steve and his children were ordered into the office, where Stephanie, Ida, Melissa, and Amy were all now being held, huddled on the floor. The gunmen appeared to be looking for money, and they found the safe. They took the cash, which was inside. There was between $4,000 and $5,000 in total. They could have stopped there and let their hostages go, but for still unknown reasons, they were not wearing masks, and instead, they just started shooting indiscriminately. And they kept shooting. All seven hostages were shot multiple times, women, men, and children. The three adults and four children were each shot in the head, and before leaving the bowling alley, the killers set fire to the paperwork on Stephanie's desk. Despite being shot five times, including being shot directly into her head, 12-year-old Melissa was still alive and conscious. By now, the fire was beginning to fill the room with smoke. Melissa managed to find the phone and call 911 at 8:33 a.m., something she had just learned at school the week earlier. Now, we are going to play this 911 call from 12-year-old Melissa, and I have to warn you, I obviously do a lot of true crime investigations and writing, but this 911 call is one of the hardest ones I have ever had the displeasure of listening to.
Emergency.
Please help me.
Well, slow down.
We were all shot and hold up.
Okay. Where are you at?
1201 East Amador, Las Cruces Bowl.
Las Cruces Bowl?
Yes.
Okay, and there were shots fired?
Yes. All of us were hurt.
Huh?
All of us were hurt. I think I'm the only one conscious.
All of you were hurt? Okay, we'll get an ambulance rolling.
Please.
Okay, what's your name?
Melissa Repass. Please hurry.
Okay, Melissa, we've got them dispatched. Did you see who did it?
No, sir. They told us all to get down. They shot me five times.
Okay. We'll get them rolling, Melissa. Just hang on. Take a deep breath. We've got patrol units in route. How many people are hurt?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Seven people are hurt?
Yes, I think.
Okay, Melissa.
It hurts.
Okay. Melissa, I've got an ambulance and I've got the police officers en route. They'll be with you just shortly.
Okay.
You didn't see what any of the men were wearing?
All of our money.
You didn't see what any kind of the men were wearing or anything?
No.
Nothing, huh? They just walked in?
Uh-huh.
Do you know if they were black men, white men?
One black man. They're both black.
Two black men?
Yeah.
Okay. No, they've left. Two black male.
Please hurry.
Okay. It's okay, Melissa.
There's a fire, too.
There's a fire?
Right on the desk. They're going to burn us up.
Are the men still there?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. They put us in the office.
They put you in the office?
Yes, I need a fire engine, too. Please help me.
And too. Okay, Melissa. She said they locked them in the office. She doesn't know if they're still there or not.
The door's open. There's a fire.
It's on Amador, yeah.
Please
can you
help.
Smell smoke, Melissa?
Yes, I can see it.
Okay.
Can I get the fire extinguisher?
Fire department, too?
Yes.
She says she smells smoke. They may have lit the building on fire.
No, it is on fire.
It is on fire.
It is.
Okay, Melissa.
Can I go get
stand by, Utility One.
Oh, ow.
Okay, Melissa, we've got them coming, hon. We've got them coming.
Is somebody there? Calling my mommy.
Okay, Melissa, there's a police officer there now, okay?
There is?
Yes, there is. He's going to try and find you.
We're in the office. Just tell him.
Stand by at 33 traffic.
Let me see.
Oh, God.
Okay.
I'm going to die.
Melissa. We've got the ambulance coming. They're just down the street. Huh? She advises all seven are shot, they're injured, they're in the office. Where's the office at, Melissa?
You go in the door, in the front desk, and then you take a right, and we're right in the building.
Okay. She says you go in the first desk, take a right, and you're right there at the office. Okay, I'm giving the directions on how to get to you, to the police officers that are there.
Oh, my God, please help me.
They're helping you, Melissa. We've got them rolling. Okay? You've got to be brave. Got to be strong now. Okay?
Oh, God. It's going to burn us right now.
Okay. Can you see flames?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's burning us.
Okay.
Oh, I got bullets in my feet.
Okay.
The bullets in my head.
The bullets in your head, too?
I can't. None of them are conscious. I'm still here.
Go ahead. I hear the officers telling you to get out. Get out.
I can't. There's nobody else.
Was that the police officer?
Yeah.
Get out?
Yeah.
Then get out.
Okay.
Okay?
Firefighters extinguished the fire, while paramedics attempted to help the injured. There were so many first responders on site, and so much water from the hoses soaking everything, any evidence left behind was immediately compromised, apart from a few footprints and a shell casing. The scene was so crazy and hectic that some of the first responders thought this was actually a training exercise, until they saw the first child's body being removed from the building. Amy Hauser, 13, Paula Hoagland, 6, and Steve Terran, 26, all died from their injuries at the scene. 2-year-old Valerie Terran was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital. Stephanie, Melissa, and Ida were the only survivors. Police began canvassing the neighborhood to try to find any witnesses to the shooting and get the killers in custody. One witness named Albert told police he had heard 6 or 7 gunshots from across the street, but he didn't think anything of it until the emergency services began to arrive at the bowling alley. Helicopters, planes, and multiple law enforcement departments quickly became involved, including the Army, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, all hunting for the killers. Being only 45 minutes from the Mexican border, police decided to put up roadblocks in case the killers tried to flee the country. At 9 a.m., police stopped a car with 4 men inside. The men and car were searched, and police found over $12,000 in cash on them. Steve Senek was brought in to identify them. Because remember, he had seen the 2 suspicious men walking through the bowling alley parking lot just before the shooting happened, but he confirmed that they were not the men he had seen in the parking lot. The police needed a clearer picture of who they were looking for, so Steve sat down with a sketch artist and gave his descriptions of the 2 men. According to Las Cruces police, the older suspect was in his late 30s or early 40s, 5'5 in height, with a medium build between 160 and 180 pounds, with textured hair. The younger suspect was in his late 20s, between 5'6 and 5'8 in height, with a medium build around 190 pounds. Steve said both men were Hispanic, a difference from what Melissa had said on her 911 call, but we have to remember that Melissa is only 12 years old, and she only saw the 2 men under extreme duress. At some point, police must have decided that Steve's depiction of the men was correct, as he was not under duress when he had seen them, unlike Melissa. However, they learned from her account that the older man had a Spanish accent, but the younger had an American accent. The descriptions of the men were made into composites and distributed to law enforcement and news stations across the United States and Mexico. We will post these sketches on our social media. Almost immediately, the police began receiving masses of tips, and they ended up opening another 2 phone lines to deal with the call volumes. Despite the number of tips received, almost 50 per hour, very few were any use to police. With the leads they'd received going nowhere, police began to look at the robbery in more detail. Though the killers stole thousands from the bowling alley, they had also left thousands of dollars behind as well. Ida told investigators that the shooters were rifling through a filing cabinet after they'd found the money in the safe. Stephanie's father and the owner of the bowling alley, Ron Senek, had been in Arizona on a golf trip and quickly traveled home when he had heard the news. But after he returns home, his actions quickly cause a lot of suspicion around the town. While his family members who had managed to survive this attack were still in the hospital recovering, Ron reopened the bowling alley, and this was just 6 days after the massacre. Rumors of organized crime and drugs began to circle the neighborhood, and Ron was right in the center of the stories. According to local news stories at the time, Ron is quoted as saying, Life is for the living. And I do want to say that I do not know what Ron's situation was like. I mean, maybe he financially had to reopen the bowling alley. I'm just saying it was definitely bad optics. But the scene was released back to Ron. The investigation at the scene was completed. It's not as if he was opening up an active crime scene. Crime Stoppers offered a reward of $12,000, and local businesses, through their Chamber of Commerce, donated another $8,000, hoping that someone would have information about the killings, but no new leads were made. On February 19th, investigators go to the hospital to visit Ida, Stephanie, and Melissa and show them some news footage. This footage is from El Paso, Texas, and this footage shows three men thought to be from New Mexico who were recently incarcerated down in the city of Juarez, just over the border in Mexico. But none of the survivors recognized any of these men. In March of 1990, the composite sketches were updated and distributed once more to news outlets. With no new information, police began to look up tips from all over the United States. But again, no potential suspects were identified. Unsolved Mysteries featured the massacre just over 2 months after the event, on Wednesday, April 25th, which was Season 2, Episode 6. And America's Most Wanted included the story on their show in 2004 and 2010, which was Season 18, Episode 7. Despite the many calls and renewed interest in the case, the leads lacked new information and the police were no closer to finding the killers. In January 1991, the bowling alley was sold at auction by the bank. The business had now been foreclosed, and Ron had filed for bankruptcy, with nearly $2 million in debt and multiple outstanding mortgages. According to Ron Senek, he'd spent a lot of time with the police, trying to help them. In fact, Ron claims that he spent every day from February 10th through February 16th at the police station just to be available to detectives on the case. However, the police reported that this wasn't the case and they'd often had to track him down. Ron was even given a polygraph test, which he passed. But Ron claimed he was treated as a suspect in the massacre and that the news reporting was incorrect. Detective Mark Myers said, "We put Ronald Senek under a microscope and we couldn't find anything. To date, all we know for sure is it was a robbery homicide." But Amy Housen's mother, Gloria, wasn't so sure. At the auction for the bowling alley, she held up a sign which read, "Non-payment may have caused four lives. Justice? The Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre has also been compared to the yogurt shop murders in Austin, Texas, on Friday, December 6th of 1991. In that case, the girls were also shot in the back of the head and the building was set on fire. This case also remains unsolved, and we will be covering this case in a future episode. Stephanie Senek eventually died in 1999. Due to the issues from her injuries. Her daughter, Melissa Repass, survived the attack and is now 34 years old. Ida Holguin has stayed out of the limelight, but she would now be in her 60s. Now 31 years later, the bowling alley killings remain a mystery. In 2011, A Nightmare in Las Cruces was released. This is a documentary based on the events of that day, prompting fresh tips, but no leads came from them. The case is still open, and according to KVIA, the reward is now up to $25,000. Information should be called into the Las Cruces Police Department at 575-528-4222. Or you can call Crime Stoppers at 575-526-8000, or visit the website nmcrimestoppers.org. Las Cruces Police Chief Jamie Montoya said, "It remains our intention to solve this case for the sake of the victims, their families and friends, and all of the residents of Las Cruces who continue to mourn the senseless tragedy that shook our city on that cold February morning a quarter of a century ago." And that is all there is. 31 years of tips and investigations, and 5 people whose lives were taken too soon because of the disgusting actions taken on this day. So go to our social media and look at the evidence posted on this case. Possibly you can help bring this case to a close and unveil its deeply rooted secrets that have lived in the darkness for so long. We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows. I'm John Dodson, and this has been The Secret Sits. Audio engineering by Gabriel Dodson. Original artwork provided by Tony Leigh.